so on and so on and so on. There's definitely a lot there, and there is a huge learning curve.
In 09 sports, Major League Baseball, Brandon Woodruff got the win as the Brewers beat the Cubs 6-0, taking two games out of three of that weekend series. The White Sox over the Rangers 8-4. In the NBA, Atlanta beat Milwaukee 111-104. The forecast now, partly sunny, breezy today, a high of 63. Cloudy tonight, a low of 60. For tomorrow, partly sunny, much warmer. Tomorrow's high, 78. Right now, 45. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the Morning Show comes from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, offering an online master's degree in health and wellness management. Learn advanced wellness program management skills and make a difference in a rewarding career in partnership with UW Extension. Details are available at uwp.edu. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. On three previous occasions, I have had the great pleasure and honor of speaking with best-selling authors. Tom Clavin. The first occasion was to talk about his book, Last Men Out, which was an amazing chronicle of the last hours of America's troops in Vietnam at the close of that conflict. More recently, we spoke about two other books, one called Dodge City, the other Tombstone. Now we talk about his most recent book, and it is amazing. It is titled Blood and Treasure, Daniel Boone and the Fight for America's First Frontier. Tom Clavin has co-written this book with Bob Drury, and they have done an amazing job of bringing to life this colorful figure from America's past, a figure in many respects sort of engulfed in fiction and fable and myth. And it is no small feat, of course, to arrive at something resembling the truth about who Daniel Boone really was and, of course, what he represented in our country's history. The book is published by St. Martin's Press. And Tom Clavin, we welcome you back to the Morning Show.
Well, thank you. I appreciate being back on the show.
First of all, this is probably the most mundane question I'm going to ask you, but I'm still really, really curious. This is one of a number of books that you have co-authored with Bob Drury. I'm just curious, how does your partnership work? What does it mean to co-author a book like this? Do you each play particular and distinct roles from each other, or how does this partnership work?
Well, it began with our first book together was called Halsey's Typhoon, which was published in 2007, and it was a World War II story, as the title implies. It was a previously largely untold story of a typhoon that struck the Third Fleet under Admiral Halsey in December 1944, and was actually the greatest loss of life suffered by the U.S. Navy in the entire war, not at the hands of the Japanese or the Germans, but at the hands of a typhoon.
Wow.
And that started as really, I mean, Bob Drury and I had already been friends. We knew each other from back in our New York newspaper days, and we were friends. And I had this story in mind, and I was happy to be talking to him about it, and he said, why don't we do it? At the time, he was a contract writer for Men's Journal. We did it as a magazine story, and that was supposed to be it. It was an interesting magazine story. And then our agent found a publisher who said, we want to expand this story into a book, which is what we did. And it was really with Halsey's typhoon that, I mean, we had no expectation that we were going to write any other books together. This was basically going to be a one-off. But we, looking back at it now, we sort of established our working relationship, which is that, I mean, we realized early on you can't have four hands on a keyboard. You can't alternate chapters. I mean, the reader really needs to read a book and just hear one author voice coming through. And so what we decided was that I was going to do the vast bulk of the research and the organizing and the structuring and everything else. And I sort of like prepare the meal, set it in front of Bob, and he goes and eats it, which is the equivalent to he does the writing. And then as batches of it are being written, it comes back to me for editing and revising. So that's basically how we work. I don't try to write passages and insert them because it's gonna be clunky, I think. So on the other hand, Bob is gonna not be, you know, saying, okay, you stay home, I'll go ahead to the Library of Congress and do research. No, that's my job. So it's worked out pretty well that we keep handing the ball off to each other during the process of the writing process. And I've never had the desire to say to Bob, listen, let's reverse roles. No, I think it works very well. We're both content with our roles. It seems to be productive. We seem to have good results, so that's what we do.
You have fantastic results and continue to work well together with this latest book called Blood and Treasure. There is, of course, no shortage of books that have already been written about Daniel Boone. As you said about doing this, did you have anything in particular in mind in terms of finding something new and distinctive and insightful to say about Daniel Boone after so many authors before you have told his story so exhaustively? What was there left to say about Daniel Boone that you wanted to say in this book?
Well, what was very important to us is that we'd never set out to write a biography of Daniel Boone. In fact, Boone kind of came a little bit late in the process. We wanted to write a book that was, in a sense, a prequel to a book that we had done called The Heart of Everything That Is. And some of your listeners may be familiar with the book. It's about the Sioux Indian leader, Red Cloud, who was the only Indian leader to win a war against the U.S. government. And his heyday was mostly in the 1850s and 1860s. And that book covered basically the last decades of the, centuries-old war between, the white immigrants who had come over from Europe and the native population of the Americas. So that in the 1870s, most of the Indians, Native American population that was still in the United States, were on reservations. There was no more territory. There was no place else to retreat to, and all the treaties had been signed and broken, and it was really the end of the war. And we, after doing a couple of books together, in between that, Lucky 666 was one, a World War II story, and Valley Forge was another one. We wanted to do a story about the earlier in the Native American white man experience. When was it that the first, let's go back to the very, we had written about basically the last frontier and the heart of everything that is. Let's go back to the first frontier when the white settlers, explorers and hunters who were on the eastern, let's say the original 13 colonies on the eastern seaboard, they started to make their way across the Appalachians and through the mountains, through the passes there, Cumberland Gap being one of the most famous ones. And basically, that the western frontier became the other side of that, of those mountains, the Ohio Valley, what later became known as Kentucky and Tennessee. And we wanted to write about those first contacts and how the first white settlements were established. And we initially thought we would like to have, like we did with The Heart of Everything That Is, have a Native American as our lead figure. Our person is like guiding us through the story, but we could. While there were many, many interesting Indian leaders, who were Shawnee and Cherokee and Cornstalk and Little Turtle and Tecumseh, for example, most of them, unfortunately, did not have a very long career. You know, they either retired because they went west to avoid the conflict, or they died or were killed. But we found every time we looked around, Daniel Boone was involved in some kind of adventure, certainly as an explorer, as a hunter. He also served in the Virginia militia. He fought in battles against the British and the Indians. And the more we looked into him, we thought he can be our guide. We're not writing a biography of Boone, although there's obviously a lot of biographical aspects to the book. But he's going to be our opening the door to us to see the whole panorama of what was the Western frontier in the 1700s.
Hmm. So this did not begin with Daniel Boone. It began with another story you wanted to tell. And as you began to tell that story, you realized that Daniel Boone would ultimately be kind of the central or seminal figure.
Yes, and another concern we had is because Daniel Boone is a very recognizable name, and people might think of the Daniel Boone of the television show, for example, with Fess Parker, which was quite popular in the 60s, and any kind of screen version, most particularly the Last of the Mohicans version that was done in the 90s with Daniel Day-Lewis as the character Hawkeye, which was based on Daniel Boone. And we thought if we start looking into who Daniel Boone really was and peeling away these fictional layers or cultural entertainment layers, would there still be enough there? Was there still enough of a fascinating character? And it was really enjoyable to find out who the real Daniel Boone was, that he was involved in all these adventures, and they were true. You know, we didn't go by just, oh, well, this might be legend, but we'll throw it in the book anyway. No, there had to be corroboration for it. There had to be factual basis for some of these adventures. You know, the kidnapping of his daughter and her two adolescent friends in July 1776. Yes, that really happened. Yes, he spent days tracking down and retaking them from the Indians who had kidnapped them. You know, there's the story about when what's called Lord Dunmore's Wars, beginning in 1774, and the British colonial governors were worried. We have surveyors and settlers and explorers and hunters on the frontier that are totally unaware that the Western tribes are massing for a huge attack. They'll be taken by surprise and slaughtered. There was one man they knew who could cover the entire frontier on foot, the entire frontier, and warn everybody and save hundreds of lives, and that was Daniel Boone. So to find out that many of these adventures were indeed true and that he's quite a remarkable man was really a rewarding experience.
We're speaking with Tom Clavin, co-author of Blood and Treasure, Daniel Boone and the Fight for America's First Frontier. You've just reminded me about a really important question that I want to ask you, namely, when it comes to not only understanding the real story of Daniel Boone, but also this larger story that is, in a sense, the main focus of your book, its primary purpose. What are the sources that are most valuable to you and were valuable to you in the writing of this story? And to what extent do you need to be careful about which sources are the most trustworthy versus those sources that are maybe heavily encrusted with a lot of fable and fiction?
That's where, you know, there's a lot of sifting that goes through. I always compare it to being like a gold prospector. You buy a creek there, and you spend the whole day, you know, lifting out sand from the creek. And when all is said and done, if you're lucky, some of your bucket contains a few tiny kernels of gold that you're going to keep and put aside. And that's, to me, something like what research is. You're sifting through a lot of sources, and you're one of the things you're doing is you have your antenna up to make sure that you're not being too gullible and accepting something as fact. You have to find out, is it corroborated? Are there more than one source that's talking about this event or this person? And so it's a rather laborious process. I happen to enjoy it, but there are a lot of people who find the research part really drudgery. I think it's, first of all, it's absolutely necessary to what I do, you know, either my work with Bob Drury or my solo work, is to do as much research and make sure it's as accurate as possible. In the case of Blood and Treasure, there's been a lot of, in more recent years, a lot of very, very good scholarship done on the Native Americans. You know, part of it's done through because of what's happened with explorations, excavations of Indian sites, the defunct Indian villages. You know, it's been really good because previously we mostly had to depend on the oral histories of tribal members, and as accurate as some of them were not. I mean, we all have memories that aren't completely accurate. Another thing that helped us a great deal is that, thankfully, Daniel Boone, in his lifetime, had become a legendary figure. And he had a long lifetime. He died, I think he was 86 or soon before his 86th birthday. And so when he was an older man, there were people who were interested in his life and adventures and came to interview him. And so there are sources that still exist of people who encountered Daniel Boone or specifically went to sit down with him and recorded his answers to their questions. Now, yes, again, you're talking about someone who, if he's in his 70s and 80s, the memory is not completely accurate, but fortunately there were more than one person that did this. And so there are some cases where you could see the memory sort of falls, go astray, but there's a consistency to many of them. So if Boone's, you know, talking about he and his wife Rebecca and what their experiences were when they first went from North Carolina to what became known as Kentucky, you could see that consistency. And you could also see that some of his older children who survived were interviewed also by people. And Nathan Boone was an example, one of his sons who was interviewed extensively about not only his own experiences with his father, but the when his father would come back from some of his exploits and adventures, what he would report to his family. And Nathan, you know, would always remember many of those details. So we didn't have, you know, what you would love to have with many people is they had kept their own diary or journal. And Boone did not do that. But we had, thankfully, because of his notoriety and fame, I guess you could say, while he was still alive, there were attempts to put down as many of his memories that he shared as possible.
I do want to mention, because this may end up coming up in the interview, perhaps it already has, the whole matter of using it in some cases the term Indian. You have right at the outset of your book a note to the reader in which you touch on this really important matter, and I think it's important for us to just kind of take this out of the way. Explain what you and your co-author Bob Drury did with this question of terminology.
Well, we first encountered this with our book, The Heart of Everything That Is, because, you know, we both took long and extensive trips separately during the research of that book to visit the Plain Indians reservations, and mine was in August 2011, and I spent time staying at the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, perfectly willing and ready to keep using the term Native American. And it was interesting, many of the people that I encountered were sort of correcting me and saying, we just call each other Indians. You know, to them, and I guess if you try and think about it objectively, there's nothing derogatory in and of itself about the word Indian. You know, you're describing a people. You're using that word to describe the indigenous population of America. And so I have no problem with Native American, and it's certainly an accurate phrase to use, but we felt that we could use Indian. It's more traditional, but it's not necessarily a derogatory term. Sometimes we do, in our book, refer to the indigenous population. Sometimes we say Native American, but for the most part, the word Indian seemed perfectly suitable. It was a one word instead of two words. And as far as we knew from our previous experience and anybody else that we've talked to in the interim, there was nothing in and of itself derogatory about it.
We're speaking with Tom Clavin, who co-authored with Bob Drury, Blood and Treasure, Daniel Boone and the Fight for America's First Frontier. One of the hardest things to understand about this period of North American history is kind of the complicated array of players that we are talking about. We are talking about the British, the French, certain settlers, immigrants, and we're talking about Native Americans, in a sense, mm-hmm. all coexisting in what at best was an uneasy alliance, but most of the time a much more tense and even destructive scenario. Explain just how challenging it is for us to kind of wrap our heads around all of the sort of conflicting forces at play in this period.
Yeah, that's a great question, because it was certainly challenging for the authors to wrap their heads around all the characters in this story, because it is quite a panorama. You're talking about a frontier that extended basically, you know, from New York State to the Great Lakes all the way down to Florida and Louisiana. And in that vast geography in the 1770s, as you just mentioned, you had the French. They you know, owned some of the territory. The Spanish owned some of the territory. The British owned a lot of the territory. You had the Europeans who had immigrated to the United States that were initially mostly British people, but people started coming from other countries, and then you had the native population that was already there, and so you have all the different tribes of tribes like the Sioux were not a factor yet because they were more Western tribes, but you had the Cherokee, you had the Shawnee, you had the Kickapoo, you could name a dozen more, and within those groups you had individuals who were important players in the story, British generals and governors, and you know, George Washington plays a role in our story because he was somebody who served in the military on the frontier, and especially in what's called known as Braddock's defeat, he was second in command to one of the worst disasters that a white military suffered at the hands of the Indians in America, and you had French military people and leaders, and then among the Native Americans you had, you know, leaders like Cornstalk and Little Turtle and Tecumseh and a whole range of members of those tribes. And so all of these people were encountering each other, and, you know, in some cases for the very first time, and many times it didn't go well. The Indians were aware, many of them did not want to have conflicts, certainly any kind of violent conflicts, with the white interlopers or intruders. Some tribes even decided to just pick up and leave and head farther west and think, okay, we'll give them this hunting grounds, and they'll be content, and they'll stay there, and that'll be the end of it, and we'll keep our separate ways. I mean, we understand now how naive that the outlook was. And you had the explorers and the hunters and the settlers were always moving farther west. I mean, there's a quote in the book from Lord Dunmore, who at the time was a colonial governor of Virginia. He said these Americans never seem content with what they have. They're always looking to see what's on the other side of the hill. And so it's a lot of what Blood and Treasure is about. I mean, the blood in the title is about the conflicts that went on. The treasure is the land. I mean, this is so much a story of land being coveted and being cherished and being sought after by varying competing groups. And many times this competition led to violence. Mm.
Speaking of violence, one of the stories here that is so intriguing and in many ways also a very sad aspect to the story is the fact that we are not, in a sense, we're not talking about the British versus the French versus the Native Americans. We also have a scenario in which the Native Americans themselves are not by any means a united front. They are a vast mm-hmm. array of various tribes, some of them in deadly conflict with one another. And mm-hmm. it's intriguing to think about how events might have moved differently, how this may have played out in some different ways, were that not have been such a factor. Can you just help our listeners understand the significance of this?
Again, I have to refer to the heart of everything that is, because what was remarkable, one of the things that was remarkable about Red Cloud was that he saw the great threat of the increasing number of white immigrants and settlers coming out west, and that if the tribes continued to fight each other, they stood no chance of retaining any of their own land for their hunting grounds. And so one of the most remarkable aspects of him is that he was able to get the tribes to unify under his leadership, and which resulted in, as I mentioned before, the only Indian leader to win an entire war against the U.S. government. But what we're seeing here, you know, 100 years earlier, is that the tribes, as you mentioned, they had so many rivalries and conflicts with each other and wars among each other. What they were warring about, there were really two things. One was honor. You know, if you could defeat another tribe, steal their horses, take possessions from them. The possessions themselves were not terribly important. It was the honor that you defeated your enemy, and you could crow about it. you had bragging rights, so to speak. And the other thing they were doing fighting over was hunting grounds. That was very important. There was no other source of survival but what you could kill and eat. Until there was increasing contact with white settlers and explorers that would trade, let's say, manufactured goods for beaver pelts and things like that, your survival was only on being able to track down and kill bear and antelope and beaver and other animals that were, you know, purposed for food. So when, as more and more white people were, you know, coming across and through the mountain passes and on these hunting grounds, unfortunately, the Indians, who had very little experience of uniting against the common enemy, they were fighting themselves at the same time that they were fighting the white people. They didn't put their differences aside, say, listen, we better rally around here. And there's a story, you know, one of the stories in the book is about the Treaty of Fort Stanwix in 1768 that the British made with the Iroquois tribe. And it was this landmark treaty because the Iroquois tribe, as part of, you know, a vow of peace, they gave up hundreds of thousands of acres to the British. And you think, wow, that's a pretty big sacrifice. But, you know, but they didn't give up Iroquois land. They gave up Shawnee land. They agreed to a treaty in which they gave away Shawnee territory to the British in return for peace. So there's another example there. Instead of, you know, having some loyalty or some unification between the tribes, they stuck it to the Shawnee. And unfortunately, that kind of disunion led to tremendous losses of land and lives of the native peoples.
I think one of the things your book does so well is help us understand this from the point of view of the Native Americans versus the perspective of the whites. At one point, the term is used, the white infestation, that to many of them, this onslaught of settlers, even those that weren't coming necessarily aggressively or destructively, nevertheless, that is how it was viewed, and we can understand how that would be. One other term that haunts me from your book is when you talk about how all of this adds up to, in effect, a slow motion genocide.
Yes.
And I think that is, it's important for us to think about that, because that's also probably one reason why we do not appreciate the immensity of this tragedy. Explain more about why you would describe this period as a slow motion genocide.
You know, genocide is a very powerful word, and certainly the United States has used it in reference to other countries, where, you know, we've protested and sometimes gotten involved militarily in places and lands around the world where, to us, we're seeing, you know, one group trying to eliminate another. Ethnic cleansing is also, you know, tied up in genocide. And so, you know, sometimes we have used diplomatic means or military means to say, to get involved and say, you can't do this because it's genocide. Genocide is a terrible thing. And I think it's been difficult for here in our own country to grasp and acknowledge that, you know, there was a genocide. I mean, when how many millions of, we don't know for sure how many millions of indigenous people were living in America when the European explorers and settlers first came here. But, you know, within a relatively short period of time, millions of these Native Americans died. Some of them were victims of violence as you know, as the settlers and explorers and hunters moved further west. You know, they brought with them military contingents that would build forts to protect them. And there were numerous wars between, you know, the white people and white military and the Indian tribes. So there were many Indians who died of violence. But a big part of what happened, too, was the disease, you know, smallpox, cholera. There were several diseases that Europeans brought to America that the Indians had never encountered before and had zero immunity to. So if a tribe suddenly, you know, one member of a tribe in at a trading a meeting with a few white explorers or hunters contracted smallpox or cholera or whatever and brought it back to their home base, you know, within weeks, if not months, you know, you'd have half the tribe could be wiped out. Mm. So we took their land and we took most of their lives. And I think if you add those two together, it's a genocide. It took about 300 years, you know, basically for when, you know, the we first landed at Jamestown on the East Coast. And, of course, you had the Spanish on the West Coast. And when we first landed in the 1500s and 1600s, to the present day, where the, you know, the Native American population is probably, you can probably count in the tens of thousands, it took centuries. That's why we call it slow motion, but I think it'd be hard to argue against genocide.
It's a staggering tragedy, and I'm so glad you tell this aspect of the story so vividly, even though some of it is very, very difficult, even painful to read. One interesting insight that you share in this book is that, at the risk of making some generalizations here, that there was a distinct difference between how the French dealt with the Native Americans versus the British. How one was willing, in a sense, to live among them, the others more intent on displacing them. Explain this distinction. It's really quite interesting, I think.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. The French did interact with the Indians in a different way. I mean, they were also occupying Indian land and claiming it for France. But their way of dealing with many of the tribes that they encountered was to give them gifts, to be friends, to try and coexist peacefully and to form alliances. And that was more of the way the French did seem to think that they could coexist, and we will never know if they were correct because they basically got kicked out in the French and Indian War. But that was their approach. The British were more like, the Indians are savages and not, they're subhuman, and they really have to do what we tell them to do. And if we think they're in the way, they have to get out of the way, or we'll sweep them away. You know, there's one of the events in the book is you know, when General Braddock and his army were leaving, I believe it was Virginia, to head into the Ohio Valley, and they're heading for Fort Duquesne, which later became Pittsburgh, I believe. And Indians came to him and said, you know, we'll work with you. We will fight with you in return for, you know, we basically keep our land, and then we could just pass it down to our you know, the next generation and generation after that. And this concept was inconceivable to General Braddock, who said there's no way that Indians inherit land. That's savages. He used the term savages. There's no way that savages inherit land. There was an enormous disdain by the British for the Native Americans, and they, they really would stoop it to, you know, that there was no low place that they wouldn't go. You know, one of the most difficult stories in the book is that when they there was an officer named Bouquet who was a rather important British officer, and he devised this scheme to reduce the number of Native Americans by he brought them to a big, you know, parley, a big convention, and the Indians were delighted where they were handing out one blanket after another, manufactured blanket after another to help them stay warm over the winter, not realizing that these blankets had been specifically infested with smallpox. So the idea was that they were going to cover themselves with these blankets and die from smallpox. So that's a good point that you make, that there was a very, very big difference between the way the Indians interacted with the French and the Indians interacted with the British. Perhaps, unfortunately, for the Indians, the British dominated after the war that ended in 1763. The French were basically kicked out, and so they had to make the best they could do with their British overseers, which is how they saw themselves.
Hmm. And that's another intriguing sort of what-if a factor in this ultimately really tragic story. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Tom Clavin, co-author with Bob Drury of Blood and Treasure, Daniel Boone and the Fight for America's First Frontier. In our closing minutes, we should talk, of course, about Daniel Boone. We've mentioned him repeatedly, but not really focused on him. And, of course, he is the central figure in this story. One of the things that you take great pains to help us understand is what Daniel Boone's attitudes were when it came to the Native people of North America. And you tell us that even as a young man, he had an interesting relationship with and attitude about the Native Americans, which you say were for him a source of wonder. Tell us on that really most basic personal level what we're talking about here.
Yeah, when Boone was a child and as an adolescent, he and his family lived on the edge of the frontier. He was born in Pennsylvania, then they moved to North Carolina. And because of that, he encountered many Indians from several different tribes, and he found them fascinating. He was not afraid of them. He never viewed them as many of his generation did, as subhuman or as savages. The way they dressed, the skills that they had in the forest, the way that they would put bear grease in their hair and the way they wore their hair fascinated him. The way their erect bearing and the way they carried themselves. He, from an early age, had a very positive view and respectful view of the Indian population. And as he got older and encountered the Indians, and some of his encounters were violent. Two of his sons were killed in battle with Indians, along with one of his brothers. So he did not have this naive view, this naive romantic view of Indians. But he did understand where they came from. He respected them. He admired them. He thought they were very intelligent people. He also... it wasn't like he had any religious differences either. I mean, Boone was a religious man, but not a devoutly religious man. And he put the Great Spirit, that concept of the Great Spirit, right up there in the same level as the view of a Christian God. He thought it was enlightening that the Indians had this view of afterlife, and some of it was similar to the Christian view, and some of it was not. And Boone became a legendary figure even among the Indians. You know, there's even part of the story of when his daughter and her two friends got kidnapped, and when the Indians who kidnapped them are leading them away deeper into the woodlands, heading to the west, and at one point the leader Indian, a fellow named Hanging Maw, asked Jemima Boone, "Are these two girls your sister?" And "They're your sisters." And Jemima answered, lying, but answered yes. She realized right away if they were considered daughters of, all three were considered daughters of Boone, they had a better chance of survival because of the respect that the Indians had of different tribes for Daniel Boone. So that's another part that made him so important as our guide into the story of Blood and Treasure, because he did not have this view, this one-dimensional, perimeter view of the indigenous people. He had an expansive, wide-ranging, embracing view of American Indians.
Hmm. Here's another question I want to ask you about concerning Daniel Boone. I think this comes up early in the book as you describe Daniel Boone as a young man. I mean, not really even a man yet, as a boy, how he loves exploring the woods and ultimately hunting and just loves the hunt. And you say that one of the reasons why he was, in a sense, a born hunter was because of one of his most important virtues, patience. And you go on to say that patience was something that served him well, not only when it came to hunting for game, but in other arenas, in many other situations throughout his life. Can you just say a word about Daniel Boone and his patience?
It did distinguish him as a hunter, made him one of the best of his time, because I personally don't hunt. I don't know a lot about it, but one of the few things I do know is that if you're hunting something that you can't control, an animal of some kind, especially a wild animal, you may have to wait for just the right moment in order to make your shot. And that was something Daniel Boone did. He waited for the right moment. He knew it would come eventually. It had to come to him almost. And, you know, that would serve him well. That would serve him well as a hunter.
We're experiencing some technical difficulties, and we'll resume this interview in just a moment. Sorry about that. Please stand by. Here is the end of this interview with the author of Blood and Treasure. Again, sorry for the interruption.
Wait for just the right moment in order to make your shot. And that was something Daniel Boone did. He waited for the right moment. He knew it would come eventually. It had to come to him almost. And, you know, that would serve him well. That would serve him well as a hunter, as an explorer, as the leader of men, as the founder of Boonesboro, the fort in Kentucky that was part of the frontier, that was the big siege by the British and Indian allies. And I'll give you another specific example. In 1778, Daniel Boone was captured by the Shawnee, and he was brought back. He was brought all the way to Detroit to meet the British governor, who tried to ransom him back, but the Indians refused. And then the Shawnee brought them back to their headquarters village in the Ohio Valley, which is where he was there for months. And he was actually adopted by the Shawnee chief and his wife as their son. And Daniel Boone was probably about 40 at the time. And Boone had to show patience. He knew at some point he was going to have to escape, because he knew at some point the Shawnee were going to attack the forts on the western frontier. Now, he didn't try. The next first day he was there, the second day, the first week, the second week, he had to bide his time. He had to hide things that were going to be used, but he would take with him to survive in the forest, because it was a journey of about 160 miles back to the fort. And eventually, when the time came, he escaped at the moment that was best. He made that 160-mile journey, got to the fort just in time to warn the fort of an impending Indian attack. So there was a perfect example of him being a very patient man. He had to wait for the right moment and take full advantage of it.
Hmm. There's another point in the book when, again, you are describing Daniel Boone as a human being that in which you use terms like an outsized sense of humanity. At one point, you say in describing something that Mr. Boone was doing, it was a typical Boone moment: slow to anger, quick to understand, and anxious to see life's ironies from another's point of view. I so appreciate the fact that you are trying to describe Daniel Boone and in a sense, what made him tick in these kind of terms.
Well, there's you know, the phrase has been adapted in different ways, but it's like walk a mile in another man's moccasin. And that's part of what Daniel Boone's personality was. He tried to understand the other point of view. He tried to understand what other people's experiences had been and what their attitudes were. And ultimately, in some cases, he didn't agree with them. But many times he did. Or if he didn't agree, he tried to understand. You know, there is the story in the book where he comes back and he's gone for over a year, I think, and his wife presents him with a daughter. And he's like, well, I can do the math. I wasn't here 9 months ago. And his wife explains, I thought you were dead, and I saw comfort in the arms of your brother Ned. And Boone, you know, he said, well, at least you kept it all in the family. Because what his comment was, I realized I married a full-blooded woman, not a portrait of a saint. He's gone for this long period of time. His wife is alone. She's got to fend for herself on the frontier. His handsome lookalike brother is right there who will take care of her. And so she had this relationship with his brother. And this did not ruin his marriage. He and his wife, Rebecca, were married for 56 years. They were totally devoted to each other. But he had that kind of enlightened, let me understand your point of view attitude.
Hmm. Fascinating. We leave it to our listeners to explore many of the specifics that we have not had a chance to explore in this interview. I do want to leave it in the last 2 minutes with just a quick word about the kind of strange way that Daniel Boone's life, later life, plays out under kind of an air of, some might say, kind of disappointment. Just explain what I'm talking about briefly, I'm afraid.
Yeah, Daniel Boone later in life, he was not a good businessman, and he kept having trouble making a living when he was getting too old to make a living by hunting. And so he did get kind of disappointed. He felt that other people didn't support him or you know, he had done so much, he felt, for the frontier and for the people around him. But there were times when he wished they had done more for him. He got to the point at one point where he left the United States. He went to live in the Spanish territory for a while. He eventually came back and lived out his late years and pretty much as a content person. But there was kind of a disappointment that he wasn't, not that he wanted to be compensated necessarily with money, but he wanted to have more recognition of the sacrifices in blood and treasure that he had made.
Well, we can read much more about not only Daniel Boone, but all the events swirling around him and his family in your amazing book, Blood and Treasure. By the way, we should probably mention to our listeners that you and your co-author, Bob Drury, do not shy away from graphic descriptions of some of the events that unfold. In a sense, this book is not for the faint of heart. But I mean, I think that's fair to say, but I'm sure you believe, and rightly so, that there is no other way to honestly tell this kind of story.
Well, we wanted to give the book a you are there kind of quality. You know, if you're still in 2021 after reading a few pages, we failed. If you're in 1773 after reading a few pages, we succeeded. And that was part of the reality at the time.
The book again is Blood and Treasure, Daniel Boone and the Fight for America's First Frontier, published by St. Martin's Press, co-authored by Bob Drury and my morning show guest today, Tom Glavin. Tom Glavin, thank you so much. It was great to reconnect with you and great to read your fascinating book. Best wishes.
Well, thank you. It was my pleasure.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, the author of a book called North by Shakespeare. which examines the possibility that there might be somebody behind the plays of William Shakespeare who deserves far greater credit than perhaps even Shakespeare himself for those amazing plays attributed to him. An intriguing book, an intriguing theory. We'll explore it tomorrow on The Morning.